I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. We all have ignorance in multiple areas of life experience, and it just so happens that I have a huge gap and need more than just a little remedial help when it comes to the sport of ice hockey. You really can't blame me. I've never lived in places particularly known for ice hockey. I grew up in sunny San Diego. That didn't help the matter very much. And I'm a total stranger to Canada and other climes north where hockey fans are plentiful. You want to hear something really funny? Today, as I was thinking about the conversation I'm about to have, I decided to test myself to see if I could pass a basic quiz on the game of ice hockey. So I started with a mental inventory of everything I know about the gear. You see, there's this little disc thingy. They call it a puck. I knew that. And I know that you score by making goals, not touchdowns, not coming back to home base. And then I started to mull over all the possible names for that stick thingy that they hit the puck with. And for the life of me, I couldn't remember. And I really thought it can't be as simple as hockey stick. But guess what? It is. I was elated to think that I was in the ballpark. Wrong metaphor. Well, I am not exaggerating my ignorance by much. I just want you to know where I'm coming from. But even if I did have deep experience with this sport, I have a totally serious observation to make about the enjoyment, the satisfaction that comes with most any type of athletic game or competition. There will always be insiders, and there are always outsiders. I am a hockey outsider. And in conversations I have heard over my lifetime about sports, I've noticed that the enjoyment of any given game is something kind of difficult to express or describe, even for insiders. Maybe for an insider, it's just so basic, so visceral, primordial, that you just don't often have protracted conversations about your beloved sport with outsiders. And there's little occasion to justify or explain your enjoyment to an insider. It just all makes sense. It's a rush, a thrill, a pleasure, a satisfaction, a challenge, sometimes even a life quest. Doesn't matter what the sport, just fill in the blank. Well, I want you to meet somebody who is enough of an ice hockey insider to have written a book about it, The Fastest Game in the World, Hockey and the Globalization of Sports. The author is Bruce Berglund. He is a scholar in the area of East European and Russian history. He's a writer for Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. And I suspect he's not only good at the game, but as a historian, he is deeper in the know about this sport than most ice hockey insiders. He's on the line with us right now. Bruce Berglund, welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you for having me, Marcus.
Yeah, is it awkward at all for us to talk because I don't get it?
You know, the intro you gave was terrific in presenting this idea of insiders and outsiders and how we talk about sports, not just hockey, but all sports. There's a professor at the University of Michigan named Andre Markovitz who immigrated to the United States from Europe. And he has this terrific idea that I've always loved, and I used to talk about it with my students, that sports are like languages. And so we can think of how we know sports, the lore and the rules and an appreciation for what happens during the game. We can talk about that in terms of the same way we know languages. So you might have a native knowledge in a particular sport. You might have a knowledge that's so advanced to be at the level of the poetic. Whereas with other sports, just as with languages, you might be a novice or a beginner or simply have a functional language. And so I've always liked that idea. And throughout my life, I've tried to learn new sports in the same way you learn languages. And I've recognized my, you could say, my limitations in understanding sports in that way. But I always enjoy speaking about whether it's a sport that I have a limited knowledge of. I enjoy talking with people who are advanced in their knowledge, or talking with people who are new to hockey, the sport that I have, you could say, a pretty advanced knowledge of. So no, I'm not worried about our conversation today at all.
Ooh, what a relief that is. And I love hearing you talk about it this way, knowing that you were the inaugural host of the New Books in Sports podcast for the New Books Network a few years back. And so you are practiced at talking to insiders, because that's the kind of podcast a lot of insiders would sign up for. The analogy, I think, is brilliant that you shared with us from, I don't remember who it was, but the idea that it's like language, native conversancy, you know, with a language or with a sport. What about your initiation? Where did it begin? At home?
Yeah. So with hockey, my dad had been a hockey player. So I grew up in Duluth, Minnesota. My dad was also from Duluth, Minnesota. He played college hockey, and I was on skates for the first time when I was 3 years old at our local rink. And he would bring me regularly to the outdoor rink in our neighborhood, and would teach me some moves and coach me a bit. And I played for a team that was based at this neighborhood park. So I grew up with the game. I grew up watching the game in Duluth at the high school level, the college level. I would watch some NHL games on television. My dad, he was a referee. He refereed high school and college hockey, and he would often bring me to the games. And so I gained this perspective of, as a referee, one, of understanding the rules, and two, of having something of a dispassionate perspective on what was going on. If you think of the work of a referee, the referee has to be right in the middle of the action, has to know the rules better than anybody else, but can't pick sides. So has to be this neutral, dispassionate observer. And I later on did some refereeing myself in both hockey and football. And I think as a historian of sports, I put that perspective, the perspective of a referee, into practice. You have to know the sport really well, but you also have to be able to step back and take a more balanced perspective.
Well, from your childhood to the way the game is played today and children learning today, hasn't the game kind of gentrified a bit?
Gentrified in what sense?
Well, you know, there's more travel involved, and it's kind of trendy now, and it's not like the thing. You know, we played street ball in San Diego as kids, and it was just kind of scrappy.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. It's very different in the sense that, and I talk about this in the book, of how the game that I grew up playing, and you know, many people my age and older, so I'm 52 years old, and when you talk to hockey old timers, they have this really rose-colored memory of the game being played outside on natural ice, so whether at a neighborhood rink like me or on a frozen pond or a frozen river. And this is the idea that still holds in hockey culture, that the true form of the game is played outside. Hours of idle play, of whether just working on your skills by yourself, skating and stick handling, or playing with friends from the neighborhood. This is you know, this traditional or so-called traditional way of playing the game still has a strong hold, especially in North America, in the United States, and in Canada. But, you know, really since the post-war period, certainly in Canada and also in the United States, hockey has been played largely indoors in indoor arenas. And also since the 1950s and 60s, there have been summer hockey camps. Back in the 1960s, there were complaints about how much the sport cost in terms of equipment. So you already have those concerns among parents of youth players, evident in the late 1950s and the early 1960s. But the fact of the matter is that hockey today is one of the most expensive youth sports. I think only lacrosse is more expensive for families in the United States in terms of just the cost of playing. And there have been studies done by, or investigations done by, Canadian newspapers, which show families can spend upwards of $15,000 to $20,000 on training and tournaments and equipment for their children during a course of a winter.
Well, you know, aside from the fact that it's become pricier, that it's less of an outdoor game, in your subtitle, that word globalization in your subtitle, that kind of leads me to infer that if things are going to go global, they have to start someplace that's local. And I'm guessing that's Canada. Am I right?
You're actually, that's the conventional idea, is that hockey begins in Canada and spreads throughout the world. And when we're talking about Canadian hockey, meaning the version of the game played with a puck, long sticks with the flat blades, played on a smaller rink, usually in an indoor space. Yes, this game originated in Eastern Canada. It originated in Montreal in the 1870s. And from there, it spread into the United States. It spread across Canada and eventually over to Europe. But the point I make in the book is that people, before the arrival of the Canadian game, people in Europe and in the United States and elsewhere in Canada were playing different versions of hockey. And in fact, they used the word hockey to describe the different games they played. In most cases, these games were played outside on a much larger ice surface. You might have anywhere from 10 to 15 players on a side. The sticks usually look like field hockey sticks with an upturned blade at the end. And instead of using a puck, in most cases, they would use a ball. So these initial or early versions of hockey were quite popular in Europe, in the United States. And when Canadian hockey with a puck, as it starts to spread, people who had already been used to playing games on sticks with skates and projectiles and goals, they saw this new form of the game and they said, hey, let's play this instead. So when Canadian hockey spread, it wasn't, you could say people didn't adopt it as something completely new. They adopted it as something that they recognized.
And did the Canadians then innovate by using the puck then? Did I hear that right? Is that one of the main distinctions?
Yes. So the Canadians, their innovation was, one, using the puck. And there's different, you could say, debate among scholars, among hockey scholars, as to where the idea of the puck came from. And one of the ideas is that it was initially used by Native Americans in the area of Nova Scotia. Likewise, the hockey stick, as you were talking about in your introduction. So we think of a stick that with a shaft that goes right about to your chin when you're standing on skates, with a long flat blade that goes flat on the ice. This style of stick also originated with the Mi'kmaq Indians of Nova Scotia. So these elements, these indigenous elements, they get mixed into the game that was played by English and Scottish Canadians in Montreal and Ottawa and Kingston. So those are the defining features of the Canadian game that then go out into the rest of the world.
Well, the story of globalization is something I do want to get to. We're going to have to do that after a short break here, because we're going to talk about some ruthless players and attitudes that come from, say, the former Soviet Union. We're going to have to talk about the Miracle on Ice a little bit. But I guess the story you have to tell before we go to a break here is, in part, it's just a hockey story, but it's more than that too, because in a way, aren't you trying to say that when hockey took off, it kind of changed the coverage of sports, at least from the TV perspective?
You know, the best compliments I've received from readers are people who have said, it's a hockey book, but it's not about hockey. It's about sports. It's about the 20th century world. And really, that's what I was aiming for in this book. Yes, it's a book about hockey, about how the sport changes and develops and becomes a global sport. But it's also about economics and politics and culture, the way that we play sports, the way that's the importance that sports have in our lives. And that's what I was aiming to do with this book.
Well, let's do take a short break, and then we're going to talk about Miracle on Ice. That story's been told so many times, but I guess given what you just said, we're going to want to know how that Miracle on Ice event in the Olympic format really did have a ripple effect through the entire sports world globally. We'll talk about it in just a moment. Stay tuned, and we'll be right back with Bruce Berglund and continue our conversation about his book, which is titled The Fastest Game in the World, Hockey and the Globalization of Sports. Thanks for listening to Constant Wonder. We are visiting with Bruce Berglund. He's author of The Fastest Game in the World, Hockey and the Globalization of Sports. Bruce, any hyperbole in that word fastest?
just a bit. If you think of even the fastest game on ice, you'd probably have to say, or the fastest sport, you'd probably have to say luge or bobsled, right? Where you can have racers getting up to 90 miles an hour.
Well, I just had to call you on that if I could. Let's talk about the fact that this Miracle on Ice victory had more of an impact than just sort of nationalistic or patriotic fervor for the winners and great dismay for the losers. And but there's something that happened there that changed sports coverage. And what do you attribute that to? I mean, just it could have been any number of sports, but that seemed to be right at the turning point.
Yeah, what I look at in the book and this. This view of the Miracle on Ice comes from research I did at the archives of the International Olympic Committee in Switzerland. And I found there the records of the IOC and their negotiations with ABC Sports. So recall back in the day in 1980, the Winter Olympics would be broadcast on ABC. We can recall Jim McKay as the studio host for the Winter Games. And so what happened in the wake of the Lake Placid Games in 1980? So you had the Miracle on Ice, the U.S. team winning gold medal. And then also recall you had speed skater Eric Heiden sweeping all five events in speed skating and winning gold in all five events. So the Winter Games that year brought in huge ratings for ABC, much higher than past television coverage of the Winter Games. And so Rune Arledge, who was at that time the president of ABC Sports, he wanted to ensure that the Winter Games would stay with ABC Sports. And there is an element of nationalism that comes in that Americans, and this is not just Americans, this is, you know, research has shown that people around the world in all different countries, they want to watch their own athletes in the Olympic Games, and they want to watch their athletes win. And this is the case with Americans. We want to watch Americans in the Olympics, summer or winter, and we want to see them win gold medals. And so 1980 was really the first time when the Americans were successful in the Winter Games. And so Rune Arledge, he goes back to the International Olympic Committee, and he plops down tens of millions of dollars to win the rights to the 1984 Olympics. The price went from $15 million for the rights to the 1980 games to $91 million for the 1984 games. Then before the games begin in 1984, Arledge goes again back to the International Olympic Committee, and he wants to secure the rights for the next games in 1988. And he ups the price to over $300 million. So in the span of 8 years, the Winter Olympics go from $15 million to over $300 million. Wow. And what that money does is this really shapes the International Olympic movement. You know, so some of the money gets caught up in corruption at the top level, but a lot of the money gets spread among the different athletics federations that are affiliated with the Olympics. So it's with this huge surge in television rights, particularly coming from the American networks, that Olympic sport, international sport, is transformed. And you can see this in the archives in terms of just with the sponsorships and with so much more money coming in to the Olympic movement, how that transforms it.
Is this the season, too, when we start getting more and more live coverage of events? Or I know there's the time zone difference that's always depending on what the venue is going to be. But the idea that people don't just want their athletes from their country winning games, as you say, but they want a quick turnaround, don't they?
Yeah, they want to watch that. You know, so those of your listeners who remember the Miracle on Ice in 1980, so it was February 22nd, 1980. Some might remember that the game, when it was televised, people saw the tape delay. They didn't see the live version of the game. So think of Al Michaels' famous call, "Do you believe in miracles?" Yes, that call had actually been recorded in the afternoon, and then the game was broadcast later that night. And what had happened is that the Soviet Union, Soviet sports officials, put pressure on the International Olympic Committee to have the game played earlier in the day so fans in Moscow could watch the hockey game live. And American officials conceded. They allowed the game to be played in the afternoon. And you know, for ABC Sports, they recognized how much money, how much more they could have had for broadcasting the game live. And so really that would be the last time that a major sporting event involving the Americans was not broadcast live in the United States.
Yeah, I guess people, as we move into modernity, the further we get into it, we don't want the smoke and mirrors anymore. We don't want to pretend that we're getting it live. We don't want to be hoodwinked. We want it straight.
No, exactly. And this is a complaint that, you know, now it's NBC that broadcasts the summer and winter games most often. And every Olympic cycle, this is a criticism they receive from viewers, right, is that there are too many edited programs. I don't know if you've ever watched coverage of the Olympics in a country outside of the United States.
No.
It's quite fascinating because you see the entire event from start to finish. And you realize how much NBC or any American network edits what we see on television. And this is really the aim of what NBC does. And going back to your question, yes, we do see the beginnings of this in 1980 in terms of presenting the Olympics not as a sporting event, but as an entertainment event, and presenting edited versions of the events, presenting a lot of profiles of the athletes. You know, so unlike when you turn on, say, an NBA game or an NFL game, you know who the athletes are. You don't need a lot of backstory in order to understand who you should be cheering for and who's the most engaging person. But with the Olympics, we don't really know who these Olympic athletes are. And so it falls upon NBC to craft the narrative so that we're drawn in to want to watch particular athletes.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Under the rubric of globalization, if this globalization of ice hockey, in particular as a sport, is happening around this time period, we're still talking Cold War. And so I'm wondering what the experience of ice hockey on our side of the Cold War was compared to the experience of ice hockey from the Soviet perspective. If I'm a citizen of the former Soviet Union watching my team, is it apples and oranges or is it all oranges? We're all experiencing the same game, or was the dynamic of engagement with the sport significantly different over there?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. And this is something I wanted to get at in the book. So in most histories of international hockey, looking at the 1980 Miracle on Ice, for instance, writers will typically focus on the game and they'll talk about the Cold War tensions that were on the ice as the two teams played. What I was more interested in, both on the North American side as well as the European and Soviet side, was to look at what you asked about in your question, is to look at how the game fit within the broader sporting culture. How was it that players and kids and families interacted with the sport? And I have a chapter, or a section, I should say, on hockey in the Soviet Union during the 1960s. And in that section, I talk about youth hockey. And I talk about the differences that you did see between the Soviet Union and North America. You had one of the big problems in the Soviet Union, and this was the case from the 1940s all the way to the end of the Soviet Union in 1991, is that there was just a shortage of equipment. You know, the Soviet economy just couldn't produce equipment to keep up with demand. And so kids who would play hockey on makeshift rinks or even on organized teams, they were just lacking basic equipment like sticks and helmets and gloves and so forth. And so a big part of the Soviet hockey experience for young kids was to scavenge throughout their neighborhoods for equipment to build their rinks, for sticks, for pads, and so forth. Whereas in the United States and Canada, you have companies that were marketing all this equipment. So that's one of the big differences. But then, you know, one of the things I try to emphasize in the book is that whether in the Soviet Union, in the United States, Canada, Sweden, Finland, you have fans who were just drawn to this fast, intense, engaging sport. And I loved looking at, not all of the photographs could get in the book, but I loved looking at Soviet archival photographs of hockey arenas. And, you know, the fans are sitting sitting on the edge of their seat with intensity, watching the game with the same intensity that you see fans doing it in the US or Canada?
Well, you know, I would like to talk a little bit with you because time is limited, but we've got time to talk about and should talk about the participation in this sport on the part of women, women's ice hockey. When did that finally become a substantial movement?
Yeah, women's ice hockey really takes off in the mid-1990s. So in the book I talk about, you have some really singular figures all the way back into the 1950s. I talk about the case of a girl named Abby Hoffman who played, she cut her hair short and she joined a peewee team in Toronto and played the entire season. She was named to the All-Star team and then revealed that she was Abby as in Abigail. And this became national and international news. So you do have instances of girls and women, you know, playing all the way back into the 50s. I should add here that in Canada, women's hockey was pretty big in the early 20th century and especially in the 1920s. So it was the Depression and then the war that really brings an end, or not entirely an end, but drops down participation in women's hockey in Canada. But then moving ahead, it's in the 1980s that girls' hockey and women's hockey begins to take off. This is mainly in Canada, particularly in Ontario, and it spreads out from there. And so we'll see gradual growth in the 80s into the early 90s. And then it's in the mid 90s. And it was striking when I looked at source materials and at participation numbers and how quickly it changes in the mid 1990s, where girls hockey in Canada, as well as in parts of the United States, becomes popular really overnight, you know, and it's a striking case of seeing a cultural shift that happens pretty dramatically.
I think this is very important because we use the word globalization and we think of that strictly in terms of geography so often, when there are other divisions across the globe. And to see women's hockey take off and hear that story, I think that's very important. I want to ask you one final question. You talked about it being fast and exciting and engaging. I want to throw in violent because I think about the brawls and the skirmishes and the out-and-out battles that can happen on an ice rink. I can't say this is unique to the sport of ice hockey, but I wonder if there are other sports where it's celebrated quite so much, apart from maybe boxing, you know. I wonder sometimes if people go to a game almost hoping kind of secretly that something violent will happen.
Oh, certainly. I would say that that's the case. You know, when I've been to games, particularly going to minor pro games, you know, when a fight breaks out, the fans jump up with kind of more fervor than they do even for a goal. So hockey fights still today tap into something in the audience that stick handling and passing and displays of skill or shooting goals don't do. And I remember going to games back in the 1970s when this was the era where you had a lot of fights. This was the time when the Philadelphia Flyers and the Boston Bruins were notorious in the NHL for playing really a rough, aggressive type of hockey. And this filtered down into college hockey that I would watch in Minnesota. It filtered down even into youth hockey. I mean, I remember youth hockey in my day was really, really a rough sport. And it was certainly the case in Canada in the 1970s. There were a number of studies that were done to look at the proliferation of fights in youth hockey in Canada. So yeah, violence and fighting, this has been a part of the game since the game's beginnings in Canada in the 1800s. And from that time in the late 1800s, you also had critics of the fighting. And this was something I look at in the book in terms of how violence and rough play was really intrinsic to hockey from the very start. This was something, you know, you have these young men of really elite status, and they wanted to play a game. Basically, hockey originates as rugby on ice. And so playing tough, running into your opponent, intimidating your opponent with hard hitting, these were all part of the game from the very beginning. And hockey today is still having to work out this how to emphasize the speed and the skill, and is it possible to have those elements be highlighted and to reduce the hitting and the violence and the fighting.
So there are actually perhaps some institutional attempts at curtailing it on the you know, you're talking to somebody who's got a little bit of pacifism in his DNA, and I just can't see myself showing up and enjoying this very much.
No. Yeah, that's really a good point. And you'll have people, you know, when you talked about institutional attempts, there have been repeated attempts throughout the history of the game to curtail fighting. One of my favorite stories from doing research, some of your listeners will be familiar with the name Ken Dryden. Ken Dryden played for the Montreal Canadiens back in the 70s. He's in the Hockey Hall of Fame. His brother, Dave Dryden, was also an NHL goalie. And I interviewed Dave and talked to him about his playing career back in the 70s. And he told me a story of how he was playing for the Edmonton Oilers. And the Players Association came up with an idea to get rid of fighting themselves. They thought, can we police ourselves and remove fighting from the game? And he went to talk to one of the players on the team, the guy who was kind of the notorious fighter. And for your listeners who've seen the film Slapshot with the Hansen brothers, this is one of the actual pro hockey players who played one of the Hansen brothers. So he's notorious in real life and in film as a fighter. And Dave Dryden went to him and said, hey, you know, can we, do you think the players ourselves that we can remove fighting from the game? And this guy who's a famous bruiser, a famous fighter, he says, oh yeah, we're so much better than that. We need to get rid of fighting. And so there were attempts, but ultimately it failed, right? The fighting continued. There have been attempts through the courts, through legal cases to get fighting out of the game, through academic studies, government inquiries, and still fighting remains. Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner, appeared before the Canadian Parliament just a couple of years ago. And the members of Parliament pressed him on this, not specifically on the issue of fighting, but on hits to the head and concussions. And he said, no, you know, I'm satisfied with the state of the game as it is.
Wow. Do you think that's a prognostication for where the game is headed in the future, that it's going to be kept this way?
You know, one of the bigger issues is it's not so much fighting that is a that's the major threat to players' health now. And this might be, you know, we still have this stereotype about hockey. Remember the old joke? I went to a hockey game and a boxing match broke out.
Yeah.
And you know, so we still have this stereotype of hockey as being beset by fighting, but really that's not the case anymore. You know, the players now are. They are so fast. They are such good athletes that NHL hockey is really defined by speed and skill.
That's very good news, I think.
Oh yeah, certainly. Oh yes, and this goes back to the title of my book. It is the fastest game in the world in that sense. In that, when you watch NHL hockey today. When you watch top level hockey, it's really thrilling in terms of just the speed and the back and forth movement of the game. The threat, though, there is still a threat to players' health, and the threat is not so much from fighting; it's just from the collisions and the body checking and the hits. Hockey is played. So I play senior league hockey, and we're a bunch of old guys. We're all slow. We play on the same size rink as NHLers, and when we run into each other, it hurts really hard.
Yeah.
And you can imagine NHL players on the same size rink. A hockey rink isn't that big. So think of guys who are 6'3", 6'4", over 200 pounds. They can skate 25 miles an hour, smashing each other into the boards. And it's just a matter of physics and physiology that if you have big, strong guys moving at a fast speed and colliding with each other, they're going to do serious damage. And that's more of the threat to players' health today, is the speed of the game, the collisions, and having all of these big, fast, skilled guys in a confined space.
So the rugby comparison is apt there in terms of the collisions and the... But I'm not sure that most rugby players are the kind of athletes I ever want to see on skates. I don't think. I'm not sure.
Yeah. But no, you're exactly right. Is that rugby was kind of the source material for early Canadian hockey, whereas. I look at globalization, the source material for early European hockey, including Soviet and Russian hockey, was soccer. So they both kind of come out of different traditions.
Wow. Well, Bruce, it's just been a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for visiting with us today on Constant Wonder. It's good to meet you.
Thanks a lot, Marcus. I appreciate the invitation.
Bruce Berglund with us. He's a scholar, and this is interesting to me, in the area of East European and Russian history. Hence, he can talk about Russian ice hockey too. But the book we've been talking about of his is titled The Fastest Game in the World, Hockey and the Globalization of Sports. So I personally may not know all that much about ice hockey, but I have a pretty good idea about the passion it provides for players and fans, and yes, for parents of young hockey players. Those parents, hard to keep them in check. We're going to hear from a hockey dad when Constant Wonder returns in just a moment. Thanks for joining with us for Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. Ah, yes, that old joke about going to the fights and a hockey game breaks out. That's ice hockey. Not just on the ice either. It's the passion of youth hockey, and it's the parents who often lose it. To learn more, I spoke with Rich Cohen, who is author of Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent.
And it just so happened we live like a quarter mile from a hockey rink, just by luck, or bad luck, good luck, whatever you want to call it. And so I got my older kid playing. I sort of made him play, and I coached and everything. And I realized at a certain point that he didn't want to play, but he was pretending that he wanted to play because he thought it made me happy. And I knew he didn't want to play, but I was pretending I believed he wanted to play because I thought it made him happy. And then at a certain point, I'm like, we're both living a lie. And so we just sat down and we said, let's not do this. I mean, when you're spending that amount of time on something you don't want to do, it's not good. So we had all this equipment left over. And my younger son, Micah, his friend started to play. He said he was interested. I said, go ahead, grab the equipment in the garage. You can use it. And he ended up playing, and I didn't pay any attention at first. And then one day I was supposed to pick him up, and I was sitting in the car, and he wasn't coming out. And I went into our rink, and I saw some kid, like, carrying the puck through everybody, making all these moves. And I'm like, that kid's really good. Who is that kid? It was Micah. Yeah, well, it took me by surprise when my son started to play and started turning out, to be pretty good and ended up on these elite teams. I thought I was somebody who was grown up, mature, adjusted, didn't care that much, like my dad said, you should be. And then I got into these games, and I found myself kind of overwhelmed by the emotions and becoming the exact sort of youth sports parent that I might have looked down on in the past. I kind of found myself completely nuts for the whole experience.
Well, I don't want to make a caricature out of you, because there is a fluidity to your relationship to this game and this context, because at some point you also kind of are able to back away from that obsessiveness to some extent. I'm thinking about that championship game and the migraine. We can get to that, but haven't you kind of had an ebb and flow of? I mean, you're just not wholesale
it's
a fanatic.
Like, it's like, listen. If you looked at me from the outside, you wouldn't say that person's going nuts. It's just a guy sitting in the stands. It's all happening inside me, and it mostly wasn't even about the game. It's like every other parent. It's like the whole politics of the team and the organization. And how much parents are involved, and you think, I don't want to be involved, but all these parents are so involved that if I don't get involved, my kid's going to suffer from it. And then you get caught up in the whole game of it, and then you forget the big truth, which is that none of this really matters very much. That the whole reason why you did it in the first place really is because my kid wanted to do it. I followed him, and because it's a good way to spend time with your kid and get him exercise and teach him teamwork and all that. But then you just find yourself, like a lot of things, caught up. But I think because of my father and because of my biology or whatever, there are certain times that I am able to step back. When you step back, you feel kind of ashamed because my dad has this other thing he says where he says, it's just a blip on the radar screen of eternity. It's just a walnut in the batter of life. And you kind of realize that that's what you're dealing with here. and that it is an unimportant, important thing, not an important thing.
Do you think that was original with him, a walnut in the batter of life?
I don't know, man. He says a lot of things, my father. He wrote a book called You Can Negotiate Anything when I was a kid, and he always said that he had coined the phrase win-win, and I didn't believe him. And then I researched it, and he kind of did.
Well, you talk about being ashamed of this. This is really interesting because getting caught in the, you know, the tidal wave of emotions of all those parents and all those families and all those kids, you've definitely gotten sucked into it.
Yeah, I mean, I do think you're saying you don't know hockey very well. I do think it's the same for, you know, the reason why it's so universal is because it's really just about being a parent. It's just amplified by the experience of hockey. It could be anything. One of my sons likes to watch the show Dance Moms, and I stick my head in there, and I'm like, oh, yep, that's the same. It's, you know, kid, it's just about, you know, getting caught up in wanting the best for your parents, for your kids, and being a little bit too involved in thinking that you're in control when you're really not in control. I mean, the kids are the ones who really decide. So you're just sort of like, I always used to go to the amusement park when I was a kid, and you'd ride those little cars, and it takes you about the third time to realize the steering wheel isn't actually connected to anything. You know, and it's sort of like that. You see, the kids basically are going to do what they're going to do, and the good kids are going to rise up and they're going to play hockey, and the kids that don't, you'd have the best kid in the world, the most talented kid, but if the kid doesn't like to play, it doesn't matter. Not going to play.
Well, I want to get into your own story because I understand you started hockey very young before, and we're going there in just a second, but first I just have to ask, the parent who doesn't realize at that amusement park that you're not really steering the vehicle, I think that's the parent to worry about and be kind of stay away from, you know, the most. They don't suspend, they don't know that they're suspending their disbelief. They really believe it.
Right. Well, you could see, and actually, I think another thing my father used to say is that kids are like pancakes. You should be able to throw out the first batch. You know, and he was joking, of course, but he had a point, which is you have to be a parent to learn all this stuff and to figure out, you know, how this works. So I always thought if you want to look at the kids who are the best hockey players or best whatever they do, it's probably the second, third kid because you use the first kid to figure out how the whole system works. And it's true that some parents probably never quite realize that they're not in control. But usually a season or two of being a sports parent teaches you that no matter what you're going to do, what's going to happen is going to happen, and no one can really stop it.
Well, is it true you started with a what do you call the stick thing? A hockey stick?
Yeah. When I was a kid, you mean?
At age 3?
Yeah, well, yes. That, which is not that abnormal, but and it was different then. We had double blades when you started, which were like two blades on each skate so you didn't fall down. And the reason why I started that early was I grew up in – we lived in a town called Libertyville, Illinois. It was very cold. The winter was very long. It wasn't like Southern California. They hadn't built the indoor malls yet, and there was really nothing to do in the winter. And my brother, who's 5 years older than me, he was playing hockey. He was like 8, and my mother would just drop us both at the rink. And I would just sort of stay there with everybody's parents, like a big communal thing with a bunch of other little brothers all day. And I just wanted to get on the ice. So they put me on skates. And I had this fear. I was having trouble skating when I was 3, 4 years old, like getting up and moving. And I had this overwhelming fear of the Zamboni, which is the big machine that, you know, resurfaces the ice between games, and that it was going to run over me. I don't know why I was scared of the Zamboni. And my brother knew the guy who ran the Zamboni, and he got him to basically bring it out and chase me with it. And I was so scared that I went from a kid who can't skate to the fastest skater anybody had ever seen in about 1 second. So that's the beginning of my hockey career. It begins in terror of being run over by the Zamboni.
I seem to remember you got a nickname out of that, too.
Well, my name is Richard, so somebody nicknamed me Rocket Richard because I was very fast. And Rocket Richard was a very famous, you know, the most famous hockey player in the world at one point in the 50s and the 60s, Maurice the Rocket Richard. So that name, and I still have friends who call me Rocket going, and if somebody calls me Rocket, I know it's somebody that I knew when I was 8, 9 years old.
Do you ever have nightmares about the Zamboni these days still?
No, but it's funny because all these years later, I still dream that I'm playing hockey. And when I can't fall asleep, I still sort of imagine what it feels like to skate up the ice with a puck, which is like a real sense memory thing that kind of relaxes me. So sometimes I feel that in the end, that's what I'm giving my son, because that's what I remember from my career. I just remember the feeling and how good it feels. And still to this day, I put on skates, and when you step on the ice, it's just such a great feeling to sort of start moving in a completely different, much faster, much more fluid way. And that's a wonderful thing that you'll be able to do his whole life.
Well, given this background of yours that you started very young and it's deep in your bones, is it kind of odd that your parents didn't hover around your games?
No, my parents, you ask my father why he wasn't more involved in that, or even a simple question like, why did you completely miss rock and roll? You know, like he never made the switch from Sinatra to the Beatles. He'd always say, I was too busy making a living. I had a family, you know, and that was their attitude. Sports were something you did for fun. You did when you were a kid. It wasn't something parents were really involved in that way. You know, they would drop us off. My mom didn't even go in the parking lot because she didn't want to get stuck in traffic. And then when they'd pick us up or somebody else would bring us home, they would just say, how'd it go? And they did. And it was clear the way they said it, they didn't really care how it went, you know? So, and now I think everything seems so much more important. And part of it is, honestly, I think about it a lot, even since the book came out, hockey now, and all these sports, there's so many different levels and it costs so much money to play. And there's so much time and money invested that people want, they expect something in return. And the way it's set up now is, if you think about how things work economically, one of the ways they work is you create stress and anxiety in people, and then you offer them the solution for that, and that costs money. And so having all these people very stressed out is kind of good for business. So you have all these parents who want the best for their kids, and they're very afraid that their kids are being left behind. They're not going to make some cut. So they get more involved to try to make sure that everything works out right. You know, that's just a different thing, and that's probably an economically driven thing and a society-wide thing. And, you know, you see it with everything. You see it even with everything. You know, my older son's going to college, and it's the same thing. Like, you got to pay for this service. You got to pay for that service. I mean, he's applying. And if you don't get into the right college, your life's not going to blah, 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 blah. And I swear, not that long ago when I was applying to college, it didn't really matter where you went to college. I mean, if you went to the University of Illinois or Illinois State or Michigan State, none of that really, it was, you know, it was going to not make a huge difference. It wasn't going to determine the fate of your life. So that has now changed, and that feeling that what team you make is going to determine what kind of life you have in high school, which is going to determine what kind of person you are, it's just added stress to everybody.
So a person could easily sour on the whole thing, and yet you're not terribly sour about the federations that have these hockey leagues?
No, because the fact is the core experience, the hockey, is so great. And when the team works together, I mean, I believe it's made my son a better person, learning how to be part of a team, learning how you have to sublimate some of your own skills and talents so the team can prosper, learning how, you got to pick each other up, you got to support each other when it gets a little rough, you got to help each other when you get knocked down. And all of that is just so great. And for all the trouble with the anxiety, the parents, the kids are mostly unaffected by it. Hockey has a great thing, which other sports don't have, which is the playing surface is surrounded by plexiglass, which creates a hard border between the parents and the kids. And inside the glass, the kids are living safely. And I learned the most from my son, the way he played, which is at one point I was upset, like a typical hockey parent, because I thought he'd been unfairly moved from the first line, where he played a lot, to the third line, where he wasn't playing as much. And I was complaining about it to the coach, to the other parents, and I got in the car to go home, and I looked at my son, and he was sitting there looking out the window eating Mike and Ike's, and he obviously didn't care. And I said, why don't you care about this? Why doesn't this bother you? He said, I don't care where they put me. It's still hockey. As long as I'm playing hockey, what do I care? Of course, I was like, oh, my God, he's right. I'm completely out of my mind here. He's the one who's the smart one here.
I want to talk more about Mike in just a little bit. We're going to take a short break. But before we do that, if there's a spectrum of parenting, of hockey parenting, that goes all the way from the uninvolvement of your parents to the, you know, the the hovering hockey parent on the other extreme, Is there a sweet spot? Is there a place on that spectrum that a person should be?
Well, if it's 1 to 10, 1 not caring and 10 being, you know, completely involved, I'd say I'm about a 6. So I think the sweet spot's probably about 3 or 4. And I think one thing, a new quick thing people can do without controlling their how their feelings, but they can just do, is they could say, I'm not going to go to all my kids' games. You know, I'm going to let my kid play games when I'm not there because it's good for him and it's good for me, or good for her and good for me. And the fact is that these teams play sometimes 80 games. It's insane.
Yeah.
So you can miss 40 games and still see 40 games if you want to go.
And that involves a lot of travel, too.
Yes, and that's one another reason why parents get upset, because if you think about it, if you're paying a lot of money, ultimately, I mean in the course of the year, and you're traveling a lot, and you don't think your kid's getting treated fairly or playing enough or being, you know, the right kind of experience, you feel like a consumer who's, you know, bought a bad product. I mean, that happens too. And they act like, sometimes they'll act like, well, this is for the good of the team. And you got to remember, this isn't the NHL. These kids aren't getting paid. They're just kids. And they're developing. So that's a big tension in youth sports, which is what's more important, developing the players and the kids as people or winning? And often, you know, the coaches will want to win because that brings them a certain amount of prestige and status. But really what the parents often want is their kids to develop. And those things are sometimes in tension.
So this really is kind of like the getting a kid into a good college. And if you pay that tuition, you expect the institution to be able to place your child well in a good job.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not. It's like we want the experience itself to be good, because there's no illusion about this level of hockey. These kids aren't going to, 90% of them, 95% are not going to play college hockey. This is it. I mean, they're playing their hockey careers right now. And that's another slight problem with it. And I, you know, everyone's so focused on what team are they going to make or not make next year that they're kind of living in the future, you know, when as the glory days of their hockey career, and I know this from my own life, is happening now. This is it. This is the peak years. This is like if they were NHL players, they're 27 years old right now, you know. So you're kind of missing it because you're so living in, you know, these expectations, planning for something that's honestly, it's not going to happen. Your kid's not going to play pro hockey.
Rich Cohen, a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone and author of Pee-wee's Confessions of a Hockey Parent. It's the year 1722. Colonists and Native Americans on the northwestern frontier trying to get along. It's not always easy, but we know who's civilized and who's savage, right? Well, a flare-up occurs. A man lies dead. You might be surprised to learn which side urged patience and forgiveness. It's a great story with parallels for today. That's tomorrow here on the show. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.